FOMO.
This book is about the science of communication and connection. Why are we able to have great, successful conversations sometimes, and at other times, even with the same people, not connect with them? And it turns out that we're living through this golden age of understanding communication and connection, and we now understand how conversations work in a way that allows us to have them more successfully.
I'm Patrick J. McGinnis, and I coined the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out, and it's why some people end up following the crowd when they should be blazing a trail of their own. But if you want to achieve greatness in business and life, you've got to break free. Come on, I'll show you how. This is FOMO Sapiens, where we explore how entrepreneurial thinkers find the inspiration and the courage to build exceptional lives. Welcome to FOMO Sapiens, the show for entrepreneurial thinkers. I'm your host, Patrick J. McGinnis. And today we are talking with a really special guest, somebody who's very esteemed. In fact, his name is Charles Duhigg, and he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of books like The Power of Habit, which spent 3 years on the bestseller list and has been translated to more than 40 languages, and also another book called Smarter, Better, Faster, also a bestseller. And today, Charles is joining me to talk about his newest book, Super Communicators, which is out now, just came out last week. Now, Charles writes for the New Yorker magazine. He's got a degree from Yale. He went to Harvard Business School a year ahead of me, actually. I didn't know him, though. I wish I had known him, but I know him now. And that's why I was so excited to have him on here, because I know how great he is. You probably know him, too, because he's on CNBC, This American Life, NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Frontline. So he has done it all. And his new book is an essential read for people who want to take bigger swings, which of course is all of us this season. So you are going to like it. We're going to jump right in, of course, as we always do, with the same question. And so I started our conversation by asking Charles this. Tell me something unexpected you learned about yourself that changed everything.
So actually, this has a very straightforward answer, which is, and it's when I was at HBS, which as an HBS grad yourself, you sort of know what that's like. Between first and second year, most people in business school, between first and second year, you're supposed to go get a job that summer with a company that you hope is going to hire you once you graduate. And I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I was thinking of going back to New Mexico and going into politics. And so I got a job that summer with a real estate private equity group. And I spent the summer, and it was wonderful people that I was working for, just like the nicest people. And what I would do is I would sit down every single day and I would look at properties that had just come on the market, and I would run them through my model to see whether it's something we should consider or not. And I would do like 10 to 15 spreadsheets a day, right? Like sort of like filling these in, figuring stuff out. And it was really boring. And so what I would do is I'd let myself listen to a This American Life as a reward while I was doing the spreadsheets. Wow. But this is like 20 years ago, so there weren't that many episodes. And so like if it was a really tough day, I'd let myself listen to two of them. But I didn't want to go through all of them because I would have run out of things to listen to. And during that summer, I was basically trying to figure out, like, am I going to do this? Am I going to come back to New Mexico and go into politics? Or am I going to become a journalist? Because I had done journalism in college and had really enjoyed it. And the journalist lifestyle is just a really interesting and fun lifestyle. And essentially during that summer, I decided the thing I learned about myself was I am someone who, if the future seems predictable, if it seems like I know the end of the story, it's really, really hard for me to get excited about it. Mm. And the thing about politics was like, I didn't know which ending of the story would happen, but I knew that there were three or four endings and I could see them all. Whereas a life in journalism, you actually have to do something different every single day. You have to learn something different every single day. And this question of how to tell stories that make people desperate to finish those stories seemed like it could interest me for the rest of my life. And so at the end of that summer, I decided to become a journalist and never really looked back. And I've been doing that ever since.
I too was a very avid listener of This American Life. I would get in that because there was an app and they give you the whole back catalog.
Yeah.
And I was always like, and I think you've been on that show. I have not been, but I was always like, this is where everything happens. And I think, you know, I'm not a journalist, but I do, you know, obviously I'm in the media space, and I do think that like I too want to be a politician. And I realized that this is far less painful.
Yes.
And also you get invited to more things. But and you can spread your ideas without having to go through an election. So
yeah.
I can understand why you made that move. But at the nexus of those two things is communication. See how I'm doing a little segue here?
No, that's and you that's have a
new bad. Thank you. Thanks so much. Your new book, which I have in my hand, and by the way, super cool cover. Super cool
thank
cover.
Thank you.
It is really sweet. It's called Super Communicators. This is coming out. Well, it's out now when we've aired the show. Talk about what this book is about. Like, what is the big idea here?
Yeah. So the big idea is that we all have moments when we are super communicators, right? One of the best ways to describe this is like, think for a minute of the person you would call if you were having a really bad day, like the person you know who's just going to make you feel better. And whenever I say this, everyone knows who that person is. It pops into their mind immediately. And that person for you is a super communicator. They know how to listen to you. They know how to show that they're listening. They know how to sort of get on the same wavelength as you and invite you to feel better or to talk about your problems. And you probably do that for other people sometimes, probably for that same person and for others. Mm. Or sometimes you walk into the meeting and you know exactly what to say to win everyone over. And you just like win the meeting, right? You just know exactly what to do. At those moments, we are super communicators. And the reason we're so good at that is because our brains have essentially evolved to know how to communicate with other people. Communication is humans' superpower. It is the thing that has allowed us to succeed as a species. Now, there are other times when you want to have a meaningful conversation with someone or you want to connect with someone and it doesn't work, right? Like something happens and it doesn't prove as rewarding as you had hoped. And the question is why? Why is that happening at those moments? And that's what this book is about. This book is about the science of communication and connection. Why are we able to have great, successful conversations sometimes, and at other times, even with the same people, not connect with them? And it turns out that we're living through this golden age of understanding communication and connection, and we now understand how conversations work in a way that allows us to have them more successfully.
You've taken on a big challenge here, which is I appreciate, which is that you're taking something, a topic that all of us probably much think we're experts in because we talk and communicate all day long. But yet, you know, you've made a very good point. Yeah, it's a superpower for humans, but yet how often do we feel that we have failed or we just objectively fail? It's like you have that conversation with somebody, you think that you agree that you've shared common ground and then you find out that in fact that has not happened.
It happens all the time, right?
It's innate to our lives. So talk about like, let's get into it. So, you know, what is the root cause? What did you find as you looked into this space?
No,
like, what's going on?
It's a great question. And let me describe this for my own life, right? So this would happen to me again and again. I would come home from work and my wife would be home and it would have been a tough day. And I would start complaining to my wife. I'd be like, you know, like my boss is a jerk and my coworkers don't appreciate me. And my wife very sensibly would give me some good advice and practical advice. She'd say like, look, why don't you take your boss out to lunch and then you guys can get to know each other a little bit better and it'll probably make things go smoother. And instead of hearing what she was telling me, instead of hearing her good advice, what I would do is inevitably I would get more upset and I'd be like, you know what? Why aren't you supporting me? And I want you to be outraged on my behalf. And then she would get frustrated because she had just given me good advice. And here I am basically attacking her for doing so. And so when I started working on the book, I wanted to figure out, you're right. We're communicators. I communicate for a living. Like why did this keep happening? Why was I so bad at this? And so I talked to all these experts and what they said is, look, here's the thing the mistake you're making. Most of us assume that a discussion is one thing. Right? A discussion is about one topic. But actually, a discussion is made up of multiple different kinds of conversations. And in particular, there's three main types of conversations that we usually have. We usually have a practical conversation, right? Where we're trying to like solve a problem or come up with a plan. Or we're having an emotional conversation where the goal is not to solve a problem. The goal is simply to express how I feel and hear how the other person feels. Or we're having a social conversation. And a social conversation is about how we relate to each other, how we relate to people outside of the group that we're talking to, how others see us. And they said, look, when you came home and you started complaining, you were having an emotional conversation. You were in an emotional mindset. But your wife replied with a practical conversation. And because you were having two different kinds of conversations at the same time, you couldn't hear each other. You couldn't connect. And so this has given rise to this big insight that there are these three fundamental kinds of conversations, and that successful communication, successful connection occurs when we're having the same kind of conversation at the same time. Within psychology, this has actually become known as the matching principle, that in order for us to connect, we have to have this, we have to match each other's form of conversation, which means I have to match you, or I have to invite you to match me. And honestly, it has changed how I talk to my wife, to be totally honest with you, as well as everyone else in my life.
FOMO.
Tudo bem, meus queridos FOMO sapiens? Now that right there was Portuguese. And as you know, I love speaking foreign languages, but I'm not alone. One in five Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off that list with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know I speak four languages, and it takes work to stay on top of them, especially with French. C'est difficile. But with Babbel, I'm able to practice practical conversations that I can actually use in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/FOMO. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/FOMO. That's spelled BABBEL.com/FOMO. Rules and restrictions may apply. Tell me if this sounds familiar. Your business gets to a certain size and the cracks start to emerge. Things you used to do in a day are taking a week. You don't have one source of truth. If this is you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. Happy birthday. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close the books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. One, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs. Those are key performance indicators in one efficient system. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know the show is all about making better decisions. And with this product, you can make better decisions because you have all the information you need right in one place. Right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/FOMO. That's netsuite.com/FOMO to get your own KPI checklist. Because you know what? KPIs are better than ice cream. netsuite.com/FOMO.
FOMO.
You know, I've had this insight. This is a, I'm going to give you like the chicken soup for the soul, sort of in the same space insight, okay. Which is that somebody told me, you know, they were complaining to me about something and I was trying to solve their problem. They said, I don't need your help. I want to be heard and hugged. Like the three H's. Have you heard about the three H's?
Right. It's heard, helped, and hugged. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now, like to your point, I was talking to my mom the other day, she was telling me some stuff and I was thinking to myself, I'm not going to try to help her right now. I'm just going to listen. And we've talked about that. And I say, mom, I'm in the H, I'm doing the hearing right now. But the thing that I find interesting, back to your point, because you're going much deeper than this heuristic that I've just said, because you're Charlie Duhigg, is whose responsibility is it to, like, is it the speaker of is the one who's communicating the complaint to sort of put it out there? Is it the listener to intuit? Like, how do we figure out which conversation we're having?
Right. No, it's a really good question. And just for anyone who's listening, so just those three H's, because they're really useful. Mm-hmm. They actually teach this in schools. So if someone comes to you with a problem or just a conversation, you can say, do you want to be heard? Do you want to be helped? Or do you want to be hugged? And those are actually the three different kinds of conversations, right? So if I say, do you want to be heard? I'm asking you, like, do you want to have like a social conversation where you want me to validate what you're saying? If you say, I want to be hugged, then that's an emotional conversation. Yeah. And it means that you want me to give you a hug to help you. And if you want to be helped, then it means it's a practical conversation. You want a solution to this problem. Yeah. So the question you asked is a really good one. Like, whose responsibility is this? And the answer is, it's everyone's responsibility, right? We should always be trying to figure out what kind of conversation we're having. Now, that being said, you only can control you, right? We have all been in conversations where we need to be the super communicator.
Yeah.
And our listener is not as talented as we are at thinking about conversation, having conversations. And so in those cases, when we feel a little bit more obligation to do this, what we should do is we should listen, what kind of conversation does this person want to have? But then also signal to them what kind of conversation we want to have. Invite them to match us. And that's really what the book is about, is it's about how to detect and diagnose the kind of conversation that's occurring and then the skills you need to match them. And then how do you invite someone else to match you? Because sometimes you want them to be on your wavelength instead of just on their wavelength.
Now, you mentioned that doing this work, it's great. Like when you write a book, you have no excuse to mess up on the thing that you supposedly have. So you really have to like, it's like when it comes to like FOMO, like I have to be, I have no excuse. I should really, you know, manage that well. And same here. How has, you mentioned it's changed the way you work. Take us into a workplace situation and show us how that plays out for you.
Okay. Well, let me do that in two ways. First, I'll describe a study that's described in the book. And the book is filled with stories. There's a story about a CIA recruiter who has to recruit overseas agents and is terrible at it at first. Or a story about Netflix and Netflix dealing with this internal controversy after a senior executive used a racial slur in a meeting. But just to tell you about one study in the book, there's this investment bank where this was like the most investment bank possible, right? It was this place where like people competed against each other all day long. They competed for deals. They competed for bonuses. They were at each other's throats. It was not uncommon for meetings to devolve into screaming matches. And so these two researchers come into this investment bank, and what they do is they say, okay, for the next week, what we're going to ask you to do is we're going to give everyone these index cards. Before every single meeting, just write down one sentence on the index card. And the point of that sentence is to say what your goal is for this meeting and what mood or tone you hope to achieve. And so people would write things down. They'd write things down like, you know, I want to figure out the budget for next year, but I want to give everyone a chance to like vent and get things off their chest. Or I want to ask Maria if she wants to take a vacation with me, but I want to make it easy for her to say no. I don't want it to be like weird and awkward. So people would write these downs. Sometimes they'd go into the meeting and they'd read their card. Most of the times they did not. And what the researchers found is that the incidence of screaming matches, disagreements, negative emotion went down 80% during that week in those meetings.
Wow.
And the reason why is because they had asked every single person just to figure out what kind of conversation do you want to have, right? And what kind of mood do you want to bring to this? And simply getting people to clarify that for themselves made it easier for them to express that to other people. And so when they went into the meeting, they would say like, look, I want to give us all a chance to get things off our chests. I don't want us to get into a fight here, but my goal is to figure out what the budget is for next year. Or Maria, do you want to come on vacation with me? But by the way, if you don't want to, that's totally fine. I'm not going to be offended. Once we know what kind of conversation we want, it becomes easier for us to detect what kind of conversation other people want and invite them to match us.
That is very powerful. So I guess if you're going in, like let's play this out though. So imagine, Charles, that let's do this like real time. So your book's out and you have a publisher, and the publisher had a promo plan and you're not happy with some of the stuff.
Yeah.
And you want to have a conversation with them that doesn't create, you don't want to tee them off because then you're going to mess up the relationship and they're probably going to like not do what you want. But you want to express displeasure and also, you know, you want to be able to have a result that makes you feel good. How would you do that conversation?
So the first thing I would do is ask questions. And in fact, what we know from research is that people who are super communicators on a regular basis, people who kind of intuit or have learned this stuff and really think about it, they tend to ask 10 to 20 times as many questions as other people. Mm-hmm. But the questions aren't often obvious. The questions like, what do you think of that? Or like, huh, that's interesting. How'd you come to that? Or like, you know, did that surprise you? They're these small questions. But what they do is they invite the other person to explain something about themselves. So the first thing I would do is I would ask them questions about what their goals are for this marketing campaign. And I would also try and ask what are known as deep questions. And a deep question is a question that invites the other person to talk about their values, their beliefs, or their experiences. So I might start by saying like, hey, can you tell me how you came to this idea about this marketing plan? And then my follow-up might be something like, when you've worked on campaigns like this in the past, how has that approach worked? Like, do you feel like it's done something important? Or I might say, how did, you know, we've looked at your marketing plan here. like, just tell me, like, what does this mean to you? Like, why does this seem like the right plan? Like, walk me through that. Both of those, they don't seem like deep questions, right? But they are deep questions because they're inviting the other person to expose something about themselves, to be a little bit vulnerable with me. Now, they might not care like what my judgment is, but the act of being a little bit more vulnerable, it makes us feel closer to the other person. And for me, the person who's asking the questions, what it does is it lets me see what their deeper goal is, right? Like if they say something like, look, we're doing this because in the past, we've tried different campaigns and some of them have worked and some of them really haven't. And we're really afraid of making a mistake. Then I know, okay, actually your top goal is avoiding a mistake. And that might be different from my top goal. My top goal might be I'm willing to take on the risk of mistakes as long as I might knock it out of the park. Now we understand each other's deeper goals. So I would start by asking those questions. And then what I would do is I'd do something called looping for understanding. It's a three-part process. And it's actually been shown the most effective way to prove to someone that you're listening to them and make sure that you're hearing them accurately. What I would do is I would ask them that question. That's step one. Step two is I would repeat back to them what I just heard them say in my own words, right? I would process it and I would try and tell them what I heard them say. And then the third step, and this is the most important step and the one that we often forget, is I would say to them, did I get that right? Because by asking them, did I get that right? You're doing two things. First of all, you're giving them some power in this conversation. You're giving them the ability to show that you're trying to match them and now you're inviting them to match you. And number two, very often we do misunderstand what someone tells us, right? Either because they've done a bad job of explaining it or because we didn't hear them accurately. And so by saying to them, did I get that right? It gives me a chance to figure out, am I actually hearing what the person is saying to me? And if I did those two things, if I start that conversation by asking some questions, in particular deep questions, and then I loop for understanding to show them that I'm listening and to make sure that we at least agree on what has been said, at that point, the rest of the conversation is going to be much, much easier.
FOMO. FOMO.
That sounds powerful because what I hear is strategy. Instead of being reactive, because what I think what happens a lot of times in a conversation that we're that's difficult or where we have emotion or we're disappointed is that even though we may ask those questions, we're not prepared to listen because we're coming from an emotional place, not from an analytical place, right? How does one prep for the convo? Like you're going in to see your boss to have that, you know, conversation that you might be a little fraught about. What is the prep that you would recommend to folks?
Well, I think what most people do is they figure out what they want to say. Mm-hmm. Right? Like I'm going to go into my boss and I'm going to tell my boss why I deserve this raise. And I want to get across these 3 points. And that's good. We should know what we want to say, but we should also know what we want to ask. Because if we're just focused on what we say, we're not listening to what the other person says, right? We're just waiting for our turn to speak. And so what's really important is to sit down. And I would say the first thing you should do is just write that sentence. What's your goal for this conversation? What mood do you hope to achieve? Okay, so once we know that, you've got a little bit more time, let's think a little bit more deeply about how that conversation is going to go. You already know the things you want to say, right? How you're going to make your case. But what are you going to ask your boss that's going to help you understand from their perspective why they might be resistant to this? Right? And the goal of those questions is not to like set them up. The goal of those questions is to genuinely learn because your boss has some perspective and you want to understand it. So what are the 3 questions that you want to ask that you think based on what you hear might influence how you make your case? And then in addition to all of that, if you have a little bit of extra time, I think at that point you can sit down and you can sort of say to yourself, okay, what are the obstacles that I'm probably going to encounter? And when I encounter them, what am I going to do? Because what we know is that most tough conversations, right, where people get messed up is when they hit an obstacle. They're so afraid of discomfort that they shy away from it. There's a great study in the paper about conversations between college friends, one of which is black and one of which is white. And they have a bunch of people have these conversations, but with half of them, they take them and they say to them, discomfort during conversations like this is normal. It's inevitable. It does not mean that the conversation is going badly. In fact, just the opposite. It means that this conversation is a normal conversation. What we want you to do is identify three potential obstacles that might emerge during this conversation and just tell us in one sentence what you're going to do if that obstacle emerges. And what they found is that not only did people's anxiety go down significantly, but actually they began to see that discomfort as an opportunity, because it really is, right? Every tough conversation has a little bit of discomfort, and the goal is not to erase the discomfort. The goal is to see the discomfort as an opportunity for us to get closer together. But if it catches you off guard, if you haven't thought about it ahead of time, that's really hard.
Yeah, the discomfort, if you can become comfortable asking the, you know, having the difficult conversation, asking the tricky question, responding, it is very powerful, because it's like you're the astronaut that's willing to go to the moon when other people just want to stay in, you know, Florida or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that's kind of interesting about this, you just made me think, is I love to do role plays. Like, I think role plays are a very interesting way to practice these skills. And I was just thinking, you know, for folks who want to try this out, like, I know it's a little crazy, but ChatGPT. I bet you could try these things out on ChatGPT.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you could. And you could tell ChatGPT, like, actually, there's a negotiation bot that a professor at Yale has created one. And I think ChatGPT just released one. You can create AI interfaces to basically kind of challenge you the way that you're anticipating they will. And I think that's a good way to practice. But you can also practice with friends, right? You can say, like,
well, that would require you to call people on the phone. And, you know, it's 2023. We don't do that
anymore. That's true. But you could just be like, look, I'm going to go ask for a raise, like role play this with me.
Yeah.
But the truth is that the reason why role playing is helpful is because it usually forces us to clarify what we really want to ask for and how we're going to react to obstacles. And we don't need a partner to do that. A partner is really useful. But if we just sit down and we push ourselves to think through this conversation, basically, before you open your mouth, you should sort of ask yourself, why am I opening my mouth? Like, what do I hope to accomplish after we have this discussion? And equally, like, what kind of conversation do I want to have? Because if I'm talking to my wife, I might want to have an emotional conversation. If I'm asking for a raise, which seems like a practical conversation, I might actually realize, no, this is an emotional conversation. Like, the issue is that I don't think my boss values me enough, that they don't respect me enough. And that's the thing that we need to talk about and explain to him. The way you show respect is through my salary, which is a very different conversation from, look, I can earn more money somewhere else, so you need to raise my salary. But if you don't know why you're having that conversation, what kind of conversation you want to have, it's going to be really messy.
Yeah, it's the role play is the hack that forces you to reverse engineer all the things that Charles is telling us to do that we could just do anyway. So it's a very instructive viewpoint. Now, I do want to go to this memory I have, because one of the things that you talk about is, like, how do we talk so that people will listen? And the first time we met, I went to see you talk about your second book, Smarter, Better,
right,
Faster.
Yeah.
And you, unfortunately, you had, like, these tech problems with your presentation. I think you were doing a keynote, and it was quite complex, but you powered through. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I need to learn how to do this, because the way he's speaking, people listen to this guy. And if I want to get into this business and, you know, do some of this stuff too, I need to learn this. And I think it is such a skill. People, and we just recently had on the show a guy called Matt Abrahams, Think Fast, Talk Smart, who's wonderful. And, you know, this is kind of his space. And so I've been thinking a lot about how now we all have, like, everybody's got a platform now, basically. Even if you have 40 followers on Instagram, you got a platform. And so therefore, the importance of being able to speak in a way that people actually listen has never been probably higher in human history. So talk about what your findings were on that front and how we can implement those.
Yeah. And it's really, so there's a story in the book about this jury, right? So this is there's not that many cases where a jury has been recorded as they go through their deliberations. There's actually only 7 of them in the history of the United States, but I was able to get my hands on the transcripts and the videotapes of one of them. And it's this guy who's on trial and this one juror is essentially a super communicator, and he figures out how to get everyone aligned around a not guilty verdict. And what's interesting is that, first of all, there's a couple of ways he does it. First of all, he asks a lot of questions. And that's one of the things I do from the stage, is I ask people questions. And sometimes it's questions where I ask them to answer from the audience. Sometimes it's just questions that I ask them to answer within their own head. But that's the first step to engaging people, is to get them thinking about questions and answering those questions, because then they feel invested in the conversation. And then what he does is he basically starts listening for what people want. And it turns out in this jury room, there's some people who basically want to talk about justice, and they want to talk about right and wrong. And then there's other people who want to talk about safety and rule of law. And the right and wrong people, they're people who are like having a social conversation. They're having a conversation about how society works. And then the safety people, the people who talk about, like, you know, letter of the law, they're practical conversationalists. They want to talk about, like, if we put this guy away, will it bring down crime? And what this one guy, John Bowley, the super communicator, recognizes is, I have to have different kinds of conversations with these two groups. And so when he matches them, he speaks in a way that they really respond to. Because the truth of the matter is that, like, if we're an emotional mindset, if we want to have an emotional conversation and someone signals to us that they're on our wavelength, then we want to hear them. Like, we want to listen to them, particularly if they say something vulnerable. So if people say something intimate and personal, if they tell a story about themselves or someone else, it's almost impossible not to listen to them. Like, we're actually hardwired to pay very, very close attention to anyone who exposes anything about themselves or tells a story that seems a little bit vulnerable, even if it's about someone else. So that's the other thing I do in speeches, is I tell a lot of stories, because those stories enchant people. They get people to listen to me. We can't not listen to a story. And the reason why those stories are so important and so meaningful is because not only are they interesting, but because they seem to tell us something vulnerable about the world or something deeper about the world. And that feels really rewarding.
Now, did this guy, this juror who was so talented, this super communicator, was he strategizing, or was this just innate in who he is as a communicator?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? Like, mm-hmm. All of us have this capacity. All of us are super communicators. We are all super communicators. For many of us, it just happens randomly, right? Sometimes we can do it and sometimes we can't. We don't know why and we don't know the difference. But there are some people, and that's kind of the goal of this book, who have thought about this just a little bit more deeply, and they know how to tap into those skills. They know how to let their instincts come out better. And I think for John Bowley, I think he knew that being on a jury is really important. It's a big, serious commitment. And so part of it was instinct, but part of it was him wanting to do the right thing. But also, he just paid more attention. It can sound like a lot, like trying to figure out in my head, like, what kind of conversation are we having and what's my goal and what's your goal? But the truth of the matter is, once we know what to look for, it becomes very automatic. It becomes very instinctual. Asking deep questions, once we've practiced a little bit, becomes automatic and instinctual. And I think for John Bowley, that's exactly what happened. He just let his instincts go, and because his instincts had been trained to look for what kind of conversation is happening, he did a better job of connecting with people.
All right, Charles, so it's time for the lightning round.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Lightning round?
Yes.
All right. This is a chance to show us how smart you are, and we've been seeing it for the last 30 minutes, so even more. All right,
no pressure, but here we go.
I got four questions for you. Questions. So the first one, let's start with the first one. Tell me a favorite quote or mantra.
Ooh, a favorite quote or mantra. Okay, so this is the one I tell my kids all the time. It is only a mistake if you don't learn from it. And I actually believe this deeply. The truth is, like, I make so many mistakes every single day, and you can get down on yourself so easily. But if you say, like, look, as long as I learned something from this, it's not really a mistake, then all of a sudden it makes things better and it forces you to actually learn something from it.
I love that one. Okay. Number two, what is your favorite productivity hack?
Ooh, my favorite productivity hack. Oh gosh. Actually this is terrible, but like I respond to emails as soon as they come in, because like
me
that
too.
Way, I have two
the
modes.
Worst.
I have two modes. Either I respond to emails right away, or I let them build up for 2 or 3 days and then I respond to them. And like, I find both of those are great hacks because it sort of reflects like what frame of mind I'm in.
Ugh, okay. Number three, what is one book that every FOMO sapiens should read?
Ooh, that's a great question. Okay. I'm going to give you two answers. The first is on The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. William James is the father of American psychology. There's one chapter in particular called the Religion of Happy Mindedness, about like what kind of an attitude is needed to be just happy, like independent of the events around you. And I found that to be really powerful. But then the second book I would recommend is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, which is just, it's a novel and it's just a wonderful book.
I have never heard either of these. I feel embarrassed.
Oh, they're great. Okay. They're great. You're here for a treat.
Final one. Now we're getting all spiritual, or not spiritual, but just deep. What's one piece of advice you give to your younger self?
Whew, that's a good question. I mean, honestly, I think that the advice I would have given is to be kinder. Like every time I've made a real mistake in my life, every time that like it's actually been a mistake, it's usually because I was not kind enough to another person. And I find that if I try and bring kindness to my interactions with others, that even if I screw something up, it usually turns out okay.
All right. So if you want to find out more about Charles, you can find him at his website. It's charlesduhigg.com. You can also write him an email. He will respond. Maybe right away, maybe in 3 days, charles@duhigg.com. And check out the book, Super Communicators, because my big takeaway here is if you do a little work, communication, if we got communication right, like most of the world's problems would be solved. And certainly you can improve your day-to-day life. So go check out the book, Charles Duhigg, author of Super Communicators. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. FOMO.
If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick J. McGinnis, on Twitter at PJ McGinnis, and on the web at FOMOsapiens.com or PatrickMcGinnis.com, where you can get all kinds of free resources to live a more decisive and entrepreneurial life. FOMO Sapiens is recorded in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis, and editing and post-production is by Josh Elstro. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me at FOMOsapiens.com and at PatrickMcGinnis.com. To advertise on FOMO Sapiens, reach out to contact@FOMOsapiens.com.